From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as Michigan decides whether to privatize mental health care, we'll hear from someone who has battled mental illness.
Mental illness is like a physical illness that said recovery is possible, but it's a process, and I'm on the road to recovery.
We discover a startling fact about end-of-life hospice care.
The heavier the person was, the less likely they were to receive hospice care at the time of death.
A treasure trove of letters written by a Michigan soldier to his mother during World War I.
I didn't realize how devoted my father was to his country, but his letters revealed it to me.
And seeking a safer rocket engine.
The rocket that put men on the moon, at the time of takeoff, it used about 6 times more power than the entire state of Michigan.
But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 100 years ago tomorrow, the United States plunged into World War I. Later in the program, we'll hear about war letters that came home from one Michigan veteran. But first, just what is it really like to rely on mental health services in Michigan? For over a year, there's been a stiff debate over how our state can better integrate the delivery of mental health services with physical health services. This is an issue states all across the country have had to address, one that involves both improving treatment outcomes and saving money. On Stateside, we've heard from the health insurance plans, the advocacy groups. We've heard from community mental health centers. All are very clear the system as it currently exists must be improved. Up for debate, however, is how best to do it and who should have control. At the heart of all of these high-level conversations about policy proposals and healthcare economics and best practices are real people. People who are some of the most vulnerable citizens among us. Today, we will hear from one of them. Jerry Nicole Wright lives in Lansing, and she is a longtime consumer of state mental health services. Jerry Nicole, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start. I understand that you have come a long, long way since you were diagnosed with a mental illness. So I want to talk a little about that journey. What has it been like for you living with a severe mental illness?
I reached out to Community Mental Health of Clinton, Eden, Ingham County years and years ago for the help that I knew that I needed.
And how did you know you needed that help?
I was in a relationship and the partner abused me, domestic violence, but we weren't married. I had no family in Lansing, and after that incident, I realized that I needed some help, some support, something to help me to recover from that incident. Then later I was diagnosed with several diagnoses and given the proper medication and received the counseling that I needed at the time. And that helped me get back on my feet.
In going to Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham counties, what did they do for you that helped you be able to put words into what was happening in your mind?
The counseling helped me to express some of the feelings that I had. Years later, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and I realized by taking the dialectic behavior therapy skills training there, it taught me a new way to think, which in turn changed my self-destructive behaviors. It was a long road. I kind of grew up in the mental health system. As a child, I was in a state home for girls and in a foster home where the mother rejected me. So growing up in the mental health system with different case managers throughout the years and different psychiatrists to prescribe the medicine, but they were with me for a while, which helped.
And when you can put a name on something, did that change the way you felt about it? I guess was being able to put a name, a diagnosis, and here's what we do and a plan of action, did that make it less fearful?
It did, yes, yes. It helped me to understand, to study, to read about, to learn about the different diagnoses that I have. I'm also recovering from an illness called schizoid affective disorder with the tendencies of bipolar, the highs and the lows. But for years, I lived it before I realized I had that diagnosis. So looking back now, I can say that, yes, you know, I understand. And now mental illness is like a physical illness that said recovery is possible, but it's a process. And I'm on the road to recovery.
Now you're on the road to recovery, and I know you're married, living in your home. You have a job at Michigan State University, and I honestly would say, Jerry Nicole, many people would consider what you have done a real success. So how do you think you were able to get to where you are today?
I believe with the help of CMH, I don't receive service there right now anymore, but I believe with the help of CMH and the DBT skills, I have been a homeowner for 14 years. I've been cigarette-free, smoke-free for 14 and a half years. Haven't self-harmed in 19 years. I've been married for 22 years, and I've also been sober for 26 years, one day at a time, by the grace of God.
And that basket of support you got from the Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham counties, I can tell you did a lot of work, but they helped you along
that
road.
They helped me.
Just so those of us who have not had that kind of interaction with a Community Mental Health Authority, what kind of services did you receive?
I went there initially, and I was talking with a psychiatrist, and he evaluated me, and I was placed in a psychiatric hospital, given treatment, put on medication. I attended programs that were offered through Community Mental Health, a day program right there at the St. Lawrence Behavioral Clinic. They had a day program, started the process of recovery. This was before my diagnosis, but still it led me to the road of my diagnosis being diagnosed.
Is there a way to put into words how important these services have been in your life?
Community Mental Health has made my life what it is today, that and also the grace of God. But without the people and also Charterhouse, I'm a member of a clubhouse. Well, actually, now I'm an ambassador because of the funding changes. I don't have the Medicaid or the Michigan Healthy or My Child or any of those types of funding to be eligible to be a regular member. But Charterhouse is a psychosocial rehabilitation program through Community Mental Health in the community where we come and we take care of our clubhouse, we gather, we have meetings, we prepare a lunch, we interact with each other, and it helps us in recovery. To be members of a clubhouse, it's been proven through evidence-based practice that clubhouses aid in recovery from mental illness, and Charterhouse has done that for me. I started Charterhouse, and I thought I'd never work again, and after so many years, Charterhouse helped me get a transition employment position, which eventually led to my job now at the Michigan State University Department of Culinary Services at the Brody Dining Hall, where I work for the past 3 years. I've been employed there part-time. I've only missed one day of work in 3 years.
That is really, really, really commendable.
Thank you.
I understand just last year you had to switch doctors. Why was that?
Because of the changes at Community Mental Health, they lost some of their general funding through the state, and other community mental health in the state of Michigan also lost funding. And then 2 years later, they realized that the loss in the general funds, they could no longer keep consumers who didn't have the Medicaid or the Michigan Healthy Plan. So now I have to go to other place for services. That's been very challenging. First, getting connected with another provider of services for mental health was challenging. And now I've seen two resident psychiatrists, and they've both increased my medication. So it's been quite challenging.
So it's kind of a challenge to have to shift gears and start over again with a new doctor.
It is challenging, right? And that's when I have to step out on faith, and I have to use my DBT skills, and I have to realize that they're professional doctors, too. They may be residents, but they're learning, and they have a supervising physician to help them. But I meet with my newer doctor in a couple days. I'm going to speak with him about possibly getting some of my medication reduced because I'm a little groggy and a little, I feel over-medicated. So I'm going to speak with him about that.
Now, do you not qualify for, you know, Healthy Michigan or Medicaid? No?
No, I don't qualify because my husband is employed through Community Mental Health. He works with adult development disabled consumers, and he has an insurance plan. But the insurance plan will not work at Community Mental Health, but it works at my other provider. I wish I could still be with Community Mental Health. I wish that the funding changes hadn't worked out the way that worked out, because myself and my husband and
about 500 consumers can no longer receive services at Community Mental Health, and I don't know how they're doing. And there's going to be more changes for Community Mental Health, and we're hoping that mental health doesn't fall into the HMOs and become for-profit, because that would really hurt the continuity of care and the quality of care that the consumers would receive at Community Mental Health throughout the state of Michigan if things were to become for-profit.
I'm talking with Jerry Nicole Wright, Lansing resident who's a longtime consumer of state mental health service, particularly for many years at the Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eden, and Ingham counties. And it's very, very clear, Jerry Nicole, you give so much credit for your recovery and the life you've been able to build to the work you've done with them. And we know there are a lot of discussions happening right now with representatives from the state, health insurance companies, advocate groups like the National Alliance on Mental Illness here in Michigan, the chapter from local community mental health centers like the one you went to, all deciding how we're going to restructure mental health services in Michigan, possibly privatizing. So talk a little bit more about what your thoughts are on what it might mean to see things change, what you hope for or what your worries are.
My concern is that the consumers will take a back seat if things do change drastically, where things become for profit, because people's pain and suffering should not be used in that way. If whoever disperses the money for the state of Michigan will receive a 10 to 18%, they'll receive that off the top of the money that should go to the consumers be going into the hands of the person who disperses the money or does it for distribution. It just shouldn't be that way. I think that there will be more problems for consumers, not just at Community Mental Health here in Clinton, Eden, Ingham County, but throughout the state. And because of stigma, people don't get the services that they need, you know. I've become a part of NAMI, the National Alliance of Mental Illness, so that I could tell my story in our own voice to help educate people about mental illness, because it's such a stigma there that stops people from getting help that they need. And if you don't get the help you need, what kind of smart choices are you going to make? They may not be smart choices if you don't get the help and support that you need. We're in a trying times right now, and we've just got to hope and try and come up with a plan to help support community mental health and different agencies that support community mental health.
Well, it's very clear that it's a good thing that community mental health was there for you, Jerry Nicole.
Well, thank you. Yes, it was. It's a blessing.
Jerry Nicole Wright, longtime consumer of mental health services in the state of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a Michigan professor explains how computer simulations could lead to better, safer rocket designs. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Two words can mean the difference between life and death if you're blasting into space. Those words, combustion instability. That makes rocket engines blow up. And if we're going to get to Mars, if we're going to keep exploring outer space, we need to have rocket engines to safely get us off the ground without exploding. Researchers from the University of Michigan, Purdue, and MIT are working to solve this engineering challenge. And one of the researchers is here with us now. Karthik Doraswamy is a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Michigan, where he directs the new Center of Excellence on Rocket Combustor Dynamics. And Karthik, your team just won a $4.2 million grant from the Air Force to do what exactly?
I'm an expert in running computational simulations of very complex problems. And the designers can use these computational simulations rather than physical tests to evaluate their number of designs. In this case, I'm looking at the problem of rocket combustor instabilities, as you mentioned. If you take a rocket, it's an incredibly complex device. It packs into it an incredible amount of energy. So if you think about the moon rocket, to give you some perspective, the rocket that put men on the moon, at the time of takeoff, it used about 6 times more power than the entire state of Michigan. And all of that is packed inside that relatively small device. When you have so much energy being packed in such a small device and for short amounts of time, then the design of these systems becomes incredibly difficult. Traditionally, design has been done using trial and error. You design something, you build something, you test something, it blows up. right? And then you keep tweaking. And from the days of Apollo to even now, we still, even though our understanding of the problem has improved, we are still like on a trial and error basis. What we want to do is, instead of having the designers design, build, and test and blow up things, we want to be able to simulate these systems on a computer so that they can virtually test them.
So that's what your team is working on. Let's do this, simulating it, not the actual losing an expensive rocket on a launch pad and risking everything and costing a lot of money.
Exactly. It takes a lot of time and money to develop these systems, and we want to reduce that. In the end, testing and, you know, designing, testing is still irreplaceable. But instead of that taking many, many years, like tens of years, we want to reduce that design time to a few years. So instead of running 20 tests or 50 tests, we want them to get away with 3 or 4 physical tests and many, many simulations.
So you're basically using mathematics.
Exactly, right?
It's stunning.
Yes, yeah.
What's the problem with the rocket technology that we have now where you get this combustion instability? What's happening inside that engine?
Yeah, if you think about a rocket, what we have is a fast-moving stream of air or oxidizer mixing with fuel. When this fuel and oxidizer mix, you have combustion or you have a flame. But because this flame is inside the rocket rather than outside it, it generates oscillations. Because the interaction of the flow with the flame generates these very large pressure oscillations. And these oscillations can either grow or they can decay, depending on the design. And of course, if they grow unboundedly, they can blow up the entire engine. This is called combustion instability.
And this is something that really has been a challenge from the beginning of the space program.
Absolutely. It's been a challenge since Apollo. And every time we design new rockets, right now, for instance, when SpaceX designs a new engine or Blue Origin or the Air Force, it is still a problem. And that is something that we qualitatively know what is happening, but quantitatively not so much. Imagine, so each of these rockets carries like hundreds of tons of payload, and they are sitting on the ground at rest, and you need to be able to accelerate that to escape velocity, right? So that's an incredible amount of energy. So that's the main challenge here.
Where are you in the research? People will wonder, how far off are we from having, I guess, can we call them comparatively safe rocket engines?
Well, I mean, in the end, we always have something that is safe. Like all of our rockets are more or less safe. But the process of getting from a design on paper to something that actually flies safely takes a long, long time and a lot of money. So we sort of know how to get there, but it takes a long time. I'm not a rocket designer, but I'm a computational scientist. So what I do is enable rocket designers to realize their designs faster. That's the goal.
When you think of what tools you have with your computer and all of that compared to the early designers in the 50s and 60s who probably just had slide rules.
You know, it's funny you bring that up because even though we have computers that are maybe a billion or trillion times faster than back in the Apollo days, the way rocket designers go about their jobs has not changed much. Because with the current technology, even if you go to the fastest supercomputer in the world and run one of these simulations, it's going to take many years to run one simulation or one design. What the Air Force wants us to do is to reduce the simulation time without losing accuracy. So this, in typical computational science terms, is called reduced order modeling. How do you take very complex simulations and data and reduce them to something that is much simpler to compute, much simpler meaning you can do it in a smaller supercomputer like the one we have in Michigan in about a matter of a week instead of many, many years on the largest supercomputer in the world? That's where we come in.
Would you go into space if you had the chance?
I would. I absolutely would. Maybe not on the rocket that I design, according to my wife. But no, ultimately, I definitely like to do that.
Giving us an idea of the kind of research that goes into making space travel happen. Karthik Duraswamy, who is a professor of aerospace engineering at U of M and director of the new Center of Excellence on Rocket Combustor Dynamics. Thank you so much for being
with
us.
Thank you for having me.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Time again to talk our state's history.
Over there, over over there. Send the word, send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming. The drums rum coming everywhere.
That rallying call written by George M. Cohan was heard all around the country and certainly here in Michigan. 100 years ago this week, the United States officially entered what was then called the Great War. Some 150,000 Michiganders served in World War I, and among them, Freeman McClintock of Lansing. His letters to his mother give us a picture of life in the Army during the Great War. With us now is our partner at the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, and we are pleased to welcome Freeman McClintock's daughter, Mary Jane McClintock Wilson. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be with you.
Thank you very much.
Mark, as the great European powers began fighting in 1914, it really wasn't very clear whether the United States would ever join the fight. Do we have any idea what the public mood in Michigan was when it came to the prospect of fighting in the trenches of Europe?
It was typical of the rest of the nation, really. This is a time when the U.S. would reelect Woodrow Wilson in 1916 under the slogan, "He kept us out of war." It's a time when the progressive movement is still fighting for suffrage. You have people concerned about lots of domestic issues, caring for the poor and mentally ill. Ford Motor Company is led by Henry Ford, who's a pacifist, but at the same time is working on mass production with the assembly line and is trying to get military contracts. And then also, he had several hundred people from Michigan go to Canada in 1914 to enlist and fight. You also have some xenophobia begin to creep in Michigan. Interestingly, Michigan was a really popular destination for German immigrants.
We know that the public mood in the United States certainly changed after the sinking of the Lusitania off the coast of Ireland, correct?
Yeah, so the Lusitania is usually marked as that seminal event. But for Michigan, again, 1916, Michigan was the lead state sending troops down to fight the Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa at the U.S.-Mexico border. And that really forced Michigan to think about better organizing their military units.
But we know ultimately Americans went to the trenches of Europe. Mary Jane, your father was one of them. Tell us a little about Freeman, your father, and his life before the war.
He was from St. John's. He was born with the automobile, and he always tinkered with motors and with the cars as they grew. And he went out west and worked with a Ford agency in Modesto, California. So he knew a lot about the automobile and how it worked.
Which I guess is why he wound up serving in the motor pool, didn't he?
That's right. He volunteered for the Motor Transport Corps. They were having a lot of trouble with Ford ambulances being repaired overseas. Mechanics over in France didn't know how to repair the motors, but the Americans did, who had worked on them. So that's why they set up this Motor Transport Corps.
So this was right up his alley, and I understand he cared for the cars of some rather important people.
Well, eventually, because when he first went over, he worked in the field with the ambulance crews, repairing their ambulances. But eventually, after the armistice, then he went to work in Paris with the headquarters and was in charge of their park there. They called it park, P-A-R-C. And he worked with Pershing's car. Well, all the big people that were there for the peace talks, like Woodrow Wilson, Franklin D. Roosevelt, he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Herbert Hoover was there. Teddy Roosevelt, he had his car. He was in charge of the maintenance of their cars.
A perfect thing for a guy from Michigan who knows about cars and car engines. Mark, of the 150,000 or so Michiganders who served in World War I, how many were wounded or hurt?
15,000 wounded and 5,000 killed. And compare that to Michigan's role in the Civil War, where we had 91,000 volunteers. And we had 14,753 deaths, but 10,000 of those were from disease. So actually the 5,000 killed in action is sort of the same from the Civil War to the World War I.
Mary Jane, when did you become aware of the letters that your father wrote to his mother?
My father, in his later years, was always talking about his life. In fact, he wanted to write his own autobiography, but he never really quite got around to it. But it was at the time when typewriters were in style. We didn't have computers, and so I used to type out what he would write So I knew a little bit about it, but I didn't know the depth of his collection. So after he died, when I was trying to inventory everything, that's when I came across the letters from his mother. And he had never talked about those before. He talked about what he did during the war. He talked about different people and different problems that he'd had to solve. But he never talked about the letters he wrote home to his mother. For some reason, I don't know. But that revealed the story to me.
And what kinds of stories did he tell your grandmother as he wrote these letters?
Well, he never talked about the battlefield. I don't think he wanted to upset his mother. But he talked about the refugees when he was first there, how he saw them going along the crowded roads with their all in carts that were drawn by their horses or donkeys or even a cow. He seemed to have a real feel for the devastation that they were experiencing. He talked about the devastation of the cathedrals. And then he talked about the joy at the armistice, too. Again, he talked about the refugees that were now returning to their homes. And right after the armistice, their corps went through some 15 or more German towns the day after the armistice. And the people there would look at them and say, "Are you English?" And they would say, "Well, we're Americans," and they would go wild. And he remarked about how the old men seemed to just bow their heads in gratitude. Children would scream with joy. But there wasn't the joy, he said, that there was in Paris. They celebrated. They just seemed to be happy and grateful to see the Americans.
And what did life have in store for your father, Freeman McClintock of Lansing? What did he do?
Well, he got into the automobile business. That's when he really came to Lansing, and he took on a Packard dealership. But he really liked the Cadillac. He was sold on the Cadillac that they used after the war over in Paris. He eventually got the Cadillac dealership and was involved with the Cadillac for some 50 years.
You took his letters and went through them and shared them in your self-published book, In His Own Words. And I'm wondering, how did going through those letters and reading his communications with his mother, how did that change your view of who your father was?
Well, I always loved my father dearly. He was so patriotic. His country meant so much to him. And one thing we haven't talked about is the USAC, that's the United States Army Ambulance Corps. That association continued to live for many, many years afterwards. And he was a part of it. And he kept in contact with the comrades, with the people he'd worked with, his fellow ambulance men, as well as those that were above him. Bingham, who was his commander, went on to be a Harvard athletic coach for many years. And they would visit back and forth. There was a strong feeling of comradeship. And when Armistice Day came, they would always contact each other and celebrate. I didn't realize how devoted my father was to his country, but his letters revealed it to me.
Mark Harvey, when you think of that war that the United States entered 100 years ago this week, it was known as the War to End War. They really believed that, didn't they?
They did, but as you also know, the U.S. really held out as long as they could. Mm-hmm. By the time the Lusitania was sunk and we were fighting the border war with Mexico and then ultimately the Zimmerman telegraph that was intercepted and publicized, we just didn't have a choice. We joined in, and Europe lost a generation, and unfortunately it was just turned out to be the beginning.
That's true. And we should ask about the Zimmerman paper. What was the Zimmerman document about?
It really was the tipping point for the U.S. It was a coded telegram sent from the German foreign minister Zimmerman to the German minister in Mexico, von Eckart, saying basically Germany was going to break their promise and begin unlimited submarine warfare. He wanted von Eckart to tell the Mexican government that if they joined them, their spoils would be getting to reclaim parts of the U.S. The British intercepted it, and it was the first great coup in cryptology where they successfully decoded it. And it was held on for just a little bit before it was published in the U.S. just to get maximum effect. And it worked because we declared war.
I'm sure that historians like you, Mark, would encourage people to make sure they preserve things like these war letters that Mary Jane has from her father to his mother. There's something about these letters, isn't there?
Yeah, it's the personal story. You know, the Archives of Michigan collects both the official government record, but also the records of private citizens, which is what these are. And together they make a powerful narrative. You get to see the official side. You get to see the private side of monumental events. Often these are things that are stacked in an attic or in a box, and people have an awareness that they shouldn't just toss them, but they're unaware of what to do with them. And my response to that is, call us. And because as with Mary Jane, we see our role not just to save these types of materials, these letters, but to cultivate and share the story. And with Mary Jane's, I had a personal connection because my grandfather, who is from this Lansing area, he was a Cadillac man through and through, and he always bought his Cadillacs at, you guessed it, McClintock Cadillac.
Isn't that something? Mary Jane, have you donated then the letters to the Michigan History Center?
Oh, yes.
They're in safe hands.
And Mark has been a great help to me in putting things together. I'm very grateful to Archives of Michigan and what they've done for me. And I know that my father's collection, not only of his letters, but all of his business records about automobile business and so forth, they're all safely put with the state archives.
Mary Jane McClintock Wilson speaking with us today about her father Freeman McClintock's letters that were written to his mother as he served in Europe during World War I. And Mark Harvey of the Michigan History Center. Thanks so much to both of you for sharing this wonderful story with us.
It's a privilege.
Thank you very much.
Up next, exploring weight and end-of-life care.
The heavier the person was, the less likely they were to receive hospice care at the time of death.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Your weight could wind up playing a more important role than you might think in the type of death you might have. A new study done for the University of Michigan Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation discovered strong connections between your weight and your end-of-life care. Dr. Jennifer Griggs is the senior author. She's a professor at the University of Michigan Medical School, and she treats patients at the U of M Comprehensive Cancer Center. So good to have you with us, Doctor. Welcome.
Thank you.
What question were you seeking to answer in this study?
We were interested in knowing whether or not obesity or even being overweight played a role in whether or not patients had access to hospice care at the end of life.
What prompted that question? I'm curious what got minds thinking about, we need to look into this. What was observed?
It started out with us wondering whether or not the physical care of a heavier patient was a barrier to receiving care in the home at end of life, which is really where most people want to be when they're dying. And then also, I have studied quality of care in obese patients for many years. And as a cancer professional, I was interested in the continuum of care because even though we hope for a cure, even though we hope for a long life, many patients with cancer ultimately die of their disease. And so although we think about survivorship care and we think about and study treatment of cancer, some of our patients do ultimately die of cancer, as everybody who's been touched by this disease does know. And so in thinking about where people die, we wanted to know, did obesity influence not only treatment decisions, which I've shown over the years with my team, we wanted to look at where people died. And hospice care is best received in the home, but some people want to die in a treatment facility on hospice. One does not need to be in a hospice facility or at home. You can be in either place, but we know that studies have shown that hospice care improves quality of life. It improves symptom management, such as shortness of breath, pain control, and even after the patient has died, families will tell us that their quality of life, their bereavement experience is better if the patient was on hospice.
So this is what we all like to kind of call a good death.
That's correct.
So you and your team dug into records from more than 5,600 senior citizens. What did you find?
Well, we used the Health and Retirement Survey, which is actually housed here at the University of Michigan, linked that to Medicare records in those participants in the Health and Retirement Study who gave us consent to do so. That's done at the time of enrollment. And we studied a large group of patients in whom we had their self-reported height and weight, in whom we were thus able to calculate their body mass index, which is really the traditional way we calculate obesity status. And we found that the heavier the person was, and we used their body mass index closest to the time of death, the less likely they were to receive hospice care at the time of death.
And why do you think this is?
Well, there's several reasons that we hypothesize may play a role. One is instrumental. It's just harder to take care of somebody on hospice if they're heavier. So repositioning the person in the bed, lifting them up, transferring them from the bed to the bathroom or a commode at the bedside is harder. It takes more people to do so. And if you're at home, you don't have 24/7 care. So just an instrumental practical point of view. It's harder to take care of people when they're heavy. It may be the same thing in a residential hospice. People who care for people in hospice, volunteers, are more likely to be injured. Hospice nurses, nurses could be more likely to be injured taking care of a heavy patient. And then there's the other thought that it could be more expensive. You need lifts to take care of people, and hospices get paid a flat fee. No matter how intense it is to take care of that patient, they don't make more money. There's no adjustment for that. So a policy implication may be that we need to reimburse hospices more if the care of the patient is more expensive. And then the third thought that we have is that doctors and hospice nurses may not recognize the signs of approaching death in a patient who's heavier.
Interesting. Why would that be?
Well, we look at somebody. You might think of somebody you've seen in the home when you go visit a relative, and you look at that person and they're wasting. So we see that wasting around the forehead, for example, or we see the cheekbones and we say this person looks like they're approaching death. In somebody who's very heavy, we may not see what our co-authors call the signposts of an impending death.
So they don't get in time.
That's
they
right.
don't get referred to hospice care in time.
That's right. So these are things we're investigating as our future work.
What kind of reaction did your study results bring? Were people surprised?
Well, this is a recently published study, so we haven't yet heard what the medical field thinks. But when we've shown it to our colleagues, many people have been very surprised, and they've asked the same questions. Why is this? And then what are we going to do about it?
And that's the next question.
That's
what,
right.
What can be done? I guess we have to think in terms of policy changes, but also perhaps medical education and perception and attitude changes? Is it a several-pronged approach?
As most good sciences, we raise more questions than answers. And because we know that hospice is really the ideal place for a dying person and their families, our hope is that this work will get people to ask the questions. And obviously, without blaming patients, we do want to raise awareness. Perhaps a family who's got a family member who's dying of cancer or living with other serious illnesses, physicians, regardless of the specialty, this was not just confined to cancer patients. These were patients with dementia, heart disease, lung disease. There were patients with all diseases included in this sample. We might need to start to think more broadly about who's eligible for hospice. I was even thinking we could make referrals independent of weight. Perhaps referrals should be done before the patient's actually seen by the referring hospice.
Hmm.
Perhaps the decision about hospice acceptance should be made before the patient's even seen by the accepting hospice.
Which means what? Who would be making that decision?
So the hospice that would be accepting the patient doesn't meet the patient.
They just sees the medical records.
That's right. They see the medical records. So they might just see just the facts and not see the patient's body habitus or the body size.
What message is in your study, Dr. Griggs, for family members? Because probably at the point that someone needs hospice care, they're probably not able to do a lot of advocating for themselves, are they? Or does it depend?
You know, a lot of doctors will say my patients and the families don't want to go on hospice. Mm. And the biggest thing I've heard from my patients and the families is, why didn't you refer me sooner? So I think the message really is as much for medical providers, nurses, hospices, and other caregivers as it is for families.
But so the message for families and patients would be what?
The message for patients and families is hospice is the best place to be towards the end of life, and learn as much as you can about what hospice has to offer.
And again, realizing that weight issue, that obesity issue could be a barrier. And maybe it's up to family members and a patient to push through that barrier.
That's right. It need not be a barrier. So many of our patients who are heavy do go on hospice, and that is the best way to get care. I think the system needs to adjust to provide the best care to heavy patients.
What do you hope will come out of this study?
Well, I hope people will perk up their ears and think about policies to remove any disincentives for hospices to be able to accept patients. Hospices have an open policy. They want to take care of patients. They want to provide the best care. It may be a block to referral. The blockage may be in the referral policies as opposed to the acceptance policies. I know hospice workers who want to provide care to these patients. What we need to do is remove any disincentive, so any cost barriers or care barriers that are in the way of accepting these patients.
The study has been published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Dr. Jennifer Griggs, who's a professor at the University of Michigan Medical School, the senior author of the study, which is titled
The Relationship of Obesity to Hospice Use and Expenditures.
And it's really, really startling findings that you found. Again, just to kind of recap, the fact that the more obese somebody is, the less likely they are to have hospice care. And so I'm sure you're hoping that this study will change that.
I am. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Griggs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan, we are failing black college students, and we can do a whole lot better. That's the warning from Kim Trent. She's a member of the Wayne State University Board of Governors, and she laid out her concerns in a piece for MichiganFuture.org, where she is a policy associate. And with us now, Kim Trent, welcome.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
So how is Michigan failing black university students?
Well, in some ways, I think Michigan is failing all college students because we've disinvested from higher education for a long time. And this is not something that's just been the last few years. There's been a change in the way we look at education, higher education, whether it's a public good or not. I mean, there was a time where I think there was pretty much consensus that the more people who were educated, the better for our society. It was a public good and not just about someone's own private kind of trajectory. Somewhere along the line, that whole message changed and people started thinking of it as an individual obligation. And that's reflected in the way that we fund higher education in our state. I graduated from Wayne State University in 1991. When I was there, the state paid 60% or so of my tuition. I paid about 30%. Now that's completely flipped. And so parents and students are responsible for 60% of the tuition cost.
Although we do know the state had a gut-wrenching, you know, depression.
But this predates, the disinvestment predates all of that. We definitely have to make choices, and I understand that. But when we're looking at the long-range goal for what we want our state to look like, what we want our per capita income to look like, we have to have investment so that we have talent here. And so, you know, because we keep saying we want people who create jobs
here.
To come.
Yep.
Well, they're not going to come unless we have talented people here. And the only way we do that is if we take homegrown people and educate them.
But what is it about what's happening, what you're seeing with students of color that made you want to write this?
So given that as a platform where everyone is being hurt, black students especially are being kind of left behind, not only because we don't have these resources on the higher education level, but because of the way we fund our K-12 system, they're going to schools that just are not getting the support that they need. And there's a mindset, not just in black schools, in all of our schools in Michigan, in all of our K-12 schools, particularly our high schools, they're still operating on the idea that a high school diploma is the end goal. And I think that we have to change the way we look at K-12 so that we really are looking at a true K-16 system so that in high school you are truly preparing students for college success. And that means beyond just test scores. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, right now our state is still very much entrenched in this idea that if you get a certain test score, you're going to be successful in college, when there's so much ample research that shows that really GPA, there are a lot of other ideas. There's a school district in the mid part of the state that actually grades students on their agency. How much do they take accountability for things like their study habits? And I mean, so those are the things that when you go to college, you really need if you're going to succeed in college.
Yet our state policymakers are fixated like lasers on standardized
about
test scores.
Standard test scores. It's not giving them the kind of broad kind of education that they really need. We talk about the six C's: critical thinking, creativity, communication, collaboration, content, and confidence. That's where smart states are really heading in that direction. We believe that the skills that you need when you go to college, if you write a paper, how to advocate for your ideas.
You've seen this problem, and it inspired you to run for the Wayne State Board of Governors. What do the numbers tell us as far as what students of color, their performance, and how they're being failed?
Our situation at Wayne State is dire. unfortunately, we're just had the kind of headline that no school wants to get, where we actually are at the bottom of the heap when we look at universities across the country for the gap between African-American students and white students on our campus. So there's about a 33-point gap between our six-year graduation rate for black students and the six-year graduation rate for white students.
That's hefty.
Which is unacceptable. Yeah. Totally unacceptable. When I got on the Board of Governors, when I ran in 2012, our six-year graduation rate was 9.5% for African-American students, which is horrific. For African-American males, it was 3%. The four-year graduation rate for African-American students was 0. Today, our six-year graduation rate for African-American students at Wayne State is 17.2%, which is still way too low. But we're moving in the right direction.
But you say in your piece this isn't just a Wayne State problem.
It's not just a Wayne. And out of the 10 bottom universities, three of them are from Michigan. Wayne State, Saginaw Valley State, and Oakland. We were looking at a differential between black students and white students. At some point, we have to take a step back and say, we're doing something wrong here in Michigan. Wayne State is a school of opportunity. We are a school by design where we want to educate first-time college students, low-income, people of color. We want to be that university that serves that population, but we're not serving them if they don't get their degree at the end of the time there.
How much of this problem, Kim, is due to big name schools outside of Michigan snapping up the high scoring, talented students of color and kind of leaving schools like Wayne State in the lurch?
There's no doubt. If you drive down Woodward Avenue in Detroit, you're going to see signs for University of Michigan, Michigan State University, Grand Valley has a presence there, Central Michigan. They're being a lot more aggressive about recruiting Detroit's kids. They're getting those Cass and Renaissance students. But I firmly believe we need to serve the Pershing and Mumford. All of our universities need to serve all of those schools. Part of what I would like to see from Wayne State University, and I think that our president believes in this, is that we have to develop better pipelines. And we have some really great programs to do that. We have a math core program that helps students learn about math from Wayne State students who come back and train them. We have a program for girls called Go Girl, which helps them get exposed to STEM careers early, seventh grade. We have some pipeline programs, but we really need to scale them up because we want to make sure that we are competing for these students because we don't want all of the talented students to go to Michigan State. And we
or
want
out
the students,
of Michigan.
Or out of
leave,
Michigan,
the,
yeah, or leave the state. We want them to stay here, you know, especially right now that Detroit is having such growth. We want to have homegrown talent here to enjoy the fruits of all that growth.
So better pipeline, pulling these kids in, not letting them leave the state or go elsewhere. But what is the cure also? That's on the part of colleges and universities. What do you see as the cure on the part of state policymakers?
We need to give schools access to cutting-edge curricular tools so that they are emphasizing, again, the six C's, these skills that employers and colleges have said are the skills that help students to succeed. You know, we have to make sure that we're emphasizing those things instead of just emphasizing test scores. And then we have to get serious about funding schools, having equity in the way we fund schools. When you look at high school graduates from the city of Detroit, the overwhelming majority of high school students who graduated from high school in 2010 did not get a degree within 6 years. I think Renaissance High School was the only high school that was above 50% of students who earned a degree within 6 years. This is an epidemic, but it's not just Detroit. People, when they think of schools failing, they only think of the city of Detroit, and that's just not the reality. All of our schools can be better. This is not just a Detroit problem, and that's a recognition that I think policymakers need to have, too.
And what's at stake, Kim, for Michigan if this is not addressed? Why does this matter?
Every politician who's worth his or her salt says that their number one priority is more jobs here in the state of Michigan. I think we need to stop thinking about jobs and think more about careers, especially in this evolving economy that we live in now. Jobs are come and go. The nature of automation is going to change the nature of work. And the number one skill you're going to have is being nimble. I don't think that our schools are preparing students to be nimble. I think even when you hear policymakers talk about, they're always talking about, oh, we need to get more welders. We need to train more people for the skilled trades. You know, my grandfather was a skilled tradesman at Ford Motor Company. And, you know, there was a time when, yes, you can get trained for something like that and have that job for 50 years and retire with a gold watch and have your second home up north. Those days are over. Those jobs are limited. Those jobs are being snuffed out by automation. And the number one skill I think that our workers need is that adaptability. And I don't hear any politicians really on either side of the aisle being honest with folks.
Well, the challenges laid out by Kim Trent, Wayne State University Board of Governors member, in her post at MichiganFuture.org. Kim, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by L.A. Billings, engineered by Bob Scon. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for listening.